That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures. Hey, everybody, welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain, and I'm excited for you guys to listen to today's episode. It's a little bit different. As usual, you know, I just invite whoever I find interesting on this podcast, and I think this is my first time having a musician on, Carrie Brothers, a guy you may know from the Garden State soundtrack, and we got introduced years ago by the older brother of someone I went to high school with, and when I was out in L.A., we would see each other when he played at the Hotel Cafe. We'd sometimes see each other in Chicago. And I just think he's a fascinating dude, his own approach to his music and the music industry. And I also, to be honest with you, think that I'm going to try to sprinkle in some folks who do some stuff that pulls us away from the news and serious topics and a bit more into the arts and things that we go to when we need to be happy. And music is one of them. I'm going to try to wrangle my guy who's a sommelier, talk about wine later. Just some more topics that kind of give us an escape, because I think we all need that a little bit right now. And Carrie's a great guy to talk to about that, just coming off a tour in Australia and other places abroad. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Carrie Brothers.
That's what she said.
Happy to welcome in singer-songwriter Carrie Brothers, who I can't even remember how we first quote-unquote met. I mean, I think it was maybe a Ware Records Hotel Cafe MySpace connection.
Bar in Chicago vibe.
Yeah, from maybe Jason Kanakis or...
Right, I think Kanakis.
Yeah,
I think
it might be that.
I blame Kanakis for most good things.
For most good things, yeah. But when I was living out in L.A. and I, for whatever reason, knew you, from whatever reason, would go check out the Hotel Cafe, and of course have been following your career from afar, so I'm so happy to have you on. And you know, it's funny when I talk to musicians because so often people who listen to their music a lot feel like they know them or like they've carried them around for different parts of their life, which you are not involved in at all, even though you're there, which is such an interesting thing, right? So let's start at the beginning. You grew up in Nashville, right? Were you actually born in Nashville?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Nashville. I was Nashville right up until I went to school at Northwestern, right until I went up to Chicago.
Yeah, so obviously, I would imagine the surrounding area of Nashville is the reason for you to decide to get into music. But was it something in the family as well, family business?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I think I reacted against country music. If anything, it was almost like, you know, growing up, it was just everywhere, and it was kind of like, oh, country music. Like no matter where you went, it was just like blaring out of speakers. And so, I mean, to me, I was the kid who like. You know, like when I was in high school, I was listening to like, you know, Morrissey and The Cure and Public Enemy while kids around me were driving in listening to like Travis Tritt.
Yeah. But the music was still everywhere. I mean, it was still the thing that people were into. So you stole that aspect of the inspiration, but went your own direction.
I think my family, like my mom played piano, my brother played guitar, and when he took off to college, he left his guitar behind. And so I just picked it up and started fiddling around, and that's kind of where I got started. But yeah, I mean, the spirit, you know, like the respect for music is just in the air in Nashville, and that was something that was probably my biggest takeaway with growing up there for sure.
So what age were you when you grabbed the guitar and just started messing around?
Probably 13, around 12 or 13. I started writing, and that was like, it was always just therapy for me. I was just, you know, anything that was going on in my life, I've never been to a therapist in my life, but I've written a lot of sad songs about it.
Right.
You know, that was kind of my reaction to adolescence was just sitting down and writing super sad songs on a guitar.
Well, it's interesting, too, because that desire to write right off the bat is unique. I think a lot of people want to copy, right? They want to pick up an instrument and play the songs that they already like, but to want to have your own songs already was probably a pretty early sign that this was something bigger than just a hobby.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was also like, sad part is, you know, a friend of mine passed away in a car accident in high school. And that was the thing where it's like, I didn't really know how to deal with that as a, you know, as a growing kid. And that was really kind of how I got all those emotions out, was playing on a guitar. And I mean, and I wrote songs, you know, I had a little four track and wrote songs forever without even thinking about getting on stage and doing it. It was really just stuff I did for me.
It was so like writing in a diary, but with music instead of.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I had shoe boxes full of takes of songs. I mean, I have hundreds of songs I wrote that never saw the light of day. I mean, I don't even know if they're any good, but that kind of got me through that period of my life for sure.
Did you care to have other people listen to it? Like even just family or friends? Did you play for anybody or was it really like a solo thing for a while?
It was all solo. I think that's why there, you know, a lot of, even now to this day, like a lot of musicians I know, a lot of people, you know, they get into it because part of it is the desire to have people applaud them and to have that acclaim and to, whatever that hole is in them that needs to be filled by, you know, love and applause. Like I never really had that. So doing this as a career, it's like it's always so, so personal for me when I write songs that the idea of it being this commercial enterprise still is confusing to me in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting. It is interesting to have that balance because there are the people that were born to entertain and then there's people who are like, these things are all coming out of me. And if I'm going to spend all my time doing this, maybe I should try to make money off of it. Cause otherwise,
right. I mean, seriously,
like, I don't have time to do anything else that would make me any money.
Because I'm a huge movie nerd and I would argue that I'm maybe even more of a movie nerd than a music nerd. And when I came out to Los Angeles, it was to make movies. Yeah. And I started a production company and produced a couple independent films. And, you know, like I had an office and an assistant and I was like, this is happening. And then, you know, my parents were psyched because they were terrified that I was even moving to LA in the first place. And then, you know, and then I ultimately realized that I was helping all these writers and directors realize their dreams and I wasn't doing it for myself and shut the whole thing down and started playing open mics when I was like 30, I guess.
Crazy.
Yeah, and just like, and completely like started my life over again, which totally freaked my mom out.
Oh, I'm sure if they were scared the first time around. That's funny too, because I tried to get myself to do PR for a while because I thought that would be a better career choice than trying to move to LA to do acting and comedy. And then it was the same thing. I'm like, wait, I'm just helping all these other people do cool things. And I want to do things.
Exactly. And it's and then I said, next thing I know, I'm like playing open mic and I was happy.
Yeah.
But you're totally right. It's like, I mean, I'm going to do this thing anyway. If I was an accountant, I'd still be going home every night writing songs. So I was like, I might as well figure out a way to make a living doing this thing.
So I'm a total extrovert who occasionally needs to be just sitting on a couch and not speaking to anyone. But most of the time I am buoyed by people being around me and trying to usually steal the spotlight and entertain, which is something I'm consistently working on myself on. But you are not that. So when you decided to do the open mics and it was about sharing something that had been personal and solo, was that difficult for you? Or was it like, oh, wow, this is even better when I share it?
It was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. But that having been said, the one thing I love to sing. I love to sing in front of people. I really, 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 really love to like hit a big note and like feel like the energy shift in a room when you do something that's cool that people react to. So that, you know, that was, I got a little taste of the bug for sure. I mean, there's, it's not like there's no ego in this thing.
Right.
When you get up on stage, you know, it's like when you get up on stage and do this, it's like there definitely is that part of me that's like, oh, wow. Okay. Well, I like it when they clap.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
Wow, they know
cool.
The words. Oh, I really like that. Okay,
I'm
amazing
totally
now. Okay,
I'm incredible. And it was something I definitely had to learn how to do. And that was kind of like the hotel cafe that you talked about. You know, was in LA. That was the home base for me to figure out how to do that.
Yeah,
because it was
a
very welcoming room of singer songwriters that. Everybody was super supportive of each other. I mean, and, you know, competitive in a friendly way. Just in that if somebody went on before you that was awesome, like, you had to step up and really bring it, like, bring the heat.
So let's go back to Northwestern. So what took you from Nashville to Northwestern? What did you hope to study, and did you already know that it was, oh, I'm going here to get ready for my big career in the movies?
I think it was the film stuff that was happening in Northwestern. And also, I knew, there's a part of my head that I knew I was going to end up in New York or L.A. for entertainment industry, whatever, you know, that I didn't quite know about. And Chicago felt like a nice middle ground between Nashville and moving to the coast, you know, like Midwestern vibe with the big city. I got a little, got a little bit of both. And also being in Evanston, not being in the city and just, you know, taking the L in and drinking and then coming back home.
Well, and obviously a great education. So you, you must have put in the work in high school when not in your room playing guitar to yourself. You were obviously a good student.
Well, my parents, you know, my mom's side of the family is all teachers, educators. My grandfather was headmaster of a school in Nashville. So it's like education was always so important in our family. And it was just like, you know, it was like, oh, no, you're going to study and get good grades.
Right.
You know, that's not, there was never like a question. But at Northwestern, but that was the thing. Then I went to Northwestern and suddenly I'm, you know, I started a little band there and was playing music there. And I was producing concerts, and I was doing basically everything but going to class, but taking advantage of everything that Chicago and that school could give me outside of actually making it to class at 9 a.m.
Right.
And you know,
I'm a little worried because I've had a lot of people on my podcast that either failed out of their first try at college because they partied too much or just didn't go. Like, I loved when I had the guy who played, you know, you would know him from The Office as David Wallace, but just a great guy. And he's like, well, I went to Stanford and I played golf, but then I stopped playing golf and I didn't go to class either. And then I got this great job at, like, you know, and I'm like, what lessons are we teaching everyone? Just
I know. Well, no, I mean, and then my summers, I actually got a gig. I lied my way into a job working at MTV in New York during the summers.
Nice. So it's like, what was the lie?
So I just created a resume that was not true.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And sent it off. And they were like, I mean, I'd done some stuff. Like, I've been producing a few things and working on projects at Northwestern. But I think I was an English major at Northwestern. So it's like, I definitely used that skill to make it sound like I was a little more ready for that than I probably was.
But, you know, then I was an English major too. BS is really the minor that you get when you earn an English major.
Absolutely. and so I was doing that in summers. And so, you know, it was weird because I was suddenly like, okay, I'm doing this. The thing that I'm studying that, you know, I'm supposed to be going to school to get a degree so that I can go do a job. I'm already doing it. So why am I still in school? And ultimately I stayed there probably more than anything for my mom.
Right.
Just, you know, to get the degree. Because they offered me a job at MTV when I was summer after junior year. Mm. And they're like, hey, come work for the president of MTV and live in New York and start your dream life. And I was like,
Yeah, that's tough.
Sorry.
Because there is like a safety valve to having the degree so that if what you think you're going out there for doesn't work out, you know. But it's also hard to put a halt on something just because you think it should take longer to get to where you want. Like, oh, I'm already here. Whoa.
Yeah, I'm here. Why am I? And I mean, the thing, at the end of the day, Northwestern to me was experience and friends. Like, right. The Northwestern mafia is real.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's such a, like, the amount of people, you know, just like, I remember, like, standing next to kegs with Seth Meyers. You know, and now it's like he comes on my TV every night. I'm like, what? It's crazy.
Well, and you became friends with Zach Braff there, right?
Yeah, Zach was a couple years under me at school. And he actually was living in New York one of the summers that I was living there. And that's when we became buds.
Well, we'll get to him later. Let's get back to, you get to L.A., that guy. You get to L.A., you're at the Hotel Cafe, you're starting to do some shows. What was the turning point for you where you were like, okay, the music thing's going to work? Or what was the moment when you were like, this is worth sticking with?
It's the old 10,000 hours thing, you know? It's like,
right.
I finally put the work in. I've never had a mentor that, like, you know, hooked me up, or it was just work. I just did the work and did it over and over and over and over again, and made all these tiny little steps that ultimately led to suddenly I'm selling out a room, and with the original music I'm writing, and I was just shocked. I mean, it was, you know, it took a lot of time to get there. I mean, I'm pretty sure I sucked when I started, and ultimately figured out how to get good enough, and also watching all these really talented people around me and what they were doing and learning from them. And to me, the Hotel Cafe, the energy of that place was the family that I felt there, even more than personally with my own music, was just finding a sense of community that was so cool that I never thought I would find in Los Angeles, that I hadn't found in previous years in Los Angeles. And once I found that community, I was like, okay, I'm going to work my ass off to earn my right to be here.
Yeah. To be a part of it. If you look back honestly at the music you were writing and performing back then to now, was there, now you look back, you're like, oh my God, I had so much to learn. I needed to be around these people. I needed to really like dive deep into this career the way that I had done with the other things that I thought I wanted to do. Or was it something that came so naturally to you that it wasn't about studying so much as just creating?
It was, I don't know. It was a little bit of both. The strange thing is the music that I was writing before I was at the Hotel Cafe, you know, like I said, I grew up listening to like Britpop, you know, big delay guitars and all that kind of stuff. And when I started playing the Hotel Cafe, I was broke with an acoustic guitar. So I ultimately had to change the way I wrote songs to fit the room, to make it make sense within, you know, the confines of this place. But it made me a much better songwriter because it stripped everything down to just writing a song. There was no, I couldn't hide it behind like cool drums and cool synths and all these other things. It was just
if only auto-tune had been around, you really would have been, it's so much easier.
Oh my God, I can sing great. it was just stripped down to just me and a guitar. And and that was the great thing about that room is that if that didn't work, then the song didn't work. And it's back to the drawing board.
So why TV and movies? Do you think that was because of your relationship with Zach Braff? Is it because that was something that you were already and are a massive fan of? Or was it your way of saying this is circumventing the system a little bit where I don't have to just convince radio stations to play it. I can bring it into people's consciousness that I think would like this music because they're watching this or that.
There's, you know, I look back now, it's funny because when I look back now and I realize especially growing up in Nashville, like I didn't have access to a lot of the kind of indie music scene that maybe people had in bigger towns. And so a lot of the music that I found was off soundtrack. You know, a lot of the music I fell in love with was like John Hughes movies and that kind of thing. And the fact that I was such a movie nerd, like, I think I wrote songs that were just inherently cinematic.
Right.
I wrote songs that were like little, the songs are little movies in my head. I mean, running this whole thing now, like running my own label and producing the records and making the videos and putting out, like I feel more akin to like an independent film director than I do a musician, because it's a whole job. And I feel like I make these little movies and they kind of have the emotional arc. These songs have like the emotional arcs of a movie. And so they just fit naturally in TV shows and movies. But I also, there was the part of me that once I had the opportunity to get in that world, yeah, it's like, I don't want to pay radio people a ton of money and cross my fingers and hope that somebody cares about this versus getting paid to have my songs, you know, on like Grey's Anatomy.
Right.
And immediately having an audience of people who care so much about that show. And if they connect with the song, then they care about the song more. And just like for me, just having come off this tour where I went to China and Australia for the first time, and I'm playing songs to mostly kids who heard my songs on TV shows. And then through that started listening to the other music and having, you know, playing a small town in China and having kids shout out like deep cuts on records because they were in a TV show. It was just crazy to me.
Yeah, that's really, it's funny you mentioned that because I remember I went to France when I was like 12 and I grew up in Lake Forest, which is, you know, a little bit north of Northwestern.
Oh yeah. I've ended up on the L there when I meet, when I passed out.
I'm sorry,
on
it's
the
called
L.
passing and out. Yeah, it's not called sleeping.
Well, anyway, woke up by somebody being like, "Kid, you got to get off here."
Yeah, this is the end here. Well, it's not a very culturally diverse area, to say the least. And I went to France with this girl. We did like a family exchange. And they all wanted me to have rap music out there. They were like, what's on your Walkman or whatever? And the only the only song I had was on the soundtrack for Reality Bites. And it was a song called Revival from this rapper from like Flint, Michigan. Me Fi Me, I think was the guy's name.
Me Fi Me.
And it wasn't until later that I like got into an area where I was like, oh man, I missed all of that amazing 80s and early 90s hip hop and rap and whatever, because I just was in an area that all we had was like Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. That was like the thing by Guns N' Roses, which is still amazing.
Still pretty good. I still have my Use Your Illusion concert t-shirt. I'm very proud of it.
Yeah. But it is funny because there were soundtracks where you wouldn't pick that thing and then you'd be like, oh, but this, like, or you'd hear a song from 40 years ago for the first time, not realizing that it wasn't a new one.
I
mean, and soundtracks really set the tone. So like you said, I remember hearing your music on Grey's Anatomy. I can tell you that like I've downloaded probably 8 songs when I used to religiously watch Grey's Anatomy. Because I heard them, and it sets the tone. You're watching a scene, you know how you're supposed to feel, the music comes in, and you're like, oh, boy, like, this song's amazing. And so I think that's a really smart approach. And that, of course, led you to what I presume is your biggest hit in Blue Eyes off of Garden State.
Let's take a quick listen to Blue Eyes.
The soundtrack won a Grammy. It was platinum selling. Was that probably your biggest moment in terms of experiencing what it's like for something just to hit and all of a sudden everybody knows it and is singing it? And
absolutely. And I was completely unprepared for it in a way. I had just hit the point where I was like, oh, I could do this. And then suddenly, you know, I mean, the history of that was, you know, I'd known Braff and then we became much closer friends when we moved out to L.A. And when I had the old production company, I was helping him when he was writing that script and like giving him notes and ideas, you know, and I even thought I was going to produce that movie for a while. And so when I shut the company down, he went off and found other people to make it. And then, you know, came back to me. And meanwhile, that's when I was doing Hotel Cafe stuff. And he just came to me and he's like, hey, can I put Blue Eyes in this movie? And I was like, absolutely.
And talk about a good friend. That nepotism. Yeah. I mean, he started out with producing and then he's like, okay, this is your new career now. Okay, we'll do this. And then you're like, no, I'm an artist now. Can I do the cover design?
Well, it's like, what happened with that was, you know, at the time I was like, oh, I'm excited to have a movie, a song in my friend's little movie. You know, Garden State at the time was kind of an under the radar thing. And it wasn't until it sold, you know, or went to Sundance and like sold and made a bunch of money that it suddenly had, you know, I was like, oh, this is going to be a thing. This is going to be something that's cool. And then the soundtrack came out and, you know, I remember I lived across the street from the Virgin Megastore in L.A. And every Sunday I would go listen to music there. And on the back wall, they'd have 1 through 25, like their top records. And I walked in on a Sunday and it was 25. I was like, what is happening?
And that's your first ever EP, right?
Yeah, well, that was the first song off the first EP I had made. And the other thing is, Sony, like, who put that record, they didn't put any money into that. It all happened, like, naturally.
Yeah.
It was just people going to see the movie and going to buy the soundtrack, and it just kind of built up, and it was amazing, like, the how organic that thing was. And it's something that I'll never, I don't think that'll ever happen again. I don't think I'll ever experience anything like that. And it was just so cool. The thing just kind of grew all the way to, you know, Grammy winning, well, you know, it was crazy. And it kicked off everything for me. And then suddenly I'm able to tour. I'm able to use my juice to put a hotel cafe tour together and go out with my friends and do that. And it changed my whole life for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be hard to imagine now because there's just so much out there, right? People don't share in cultural and pop culture moments the same way they used to because there's a million of them. And then I think also there was something really special with that movie because not only was the music perfectly fit with all of the moments and beats and tone of it, but there's even the moment where he's having characters in the film talk about it, right? With the Shins, which again, that was like such a big thing for them was to have the character literally tell her, you're going to love them. Like, you know, whatever.
The song changed your life, right?
That's the kind of boost any musician can get behind, right? Unless you're already like the Rolling Stones, having the characters actually talk about how great your music is such a big thing. So did things change pretty drastically from you from there on? Because for your very first song off your very first EP to be a hit, is it hard then to then build off that and feel like, oh, well, from this means that I'm now going to be the world's greatest musician and superstar because everything, this is where I'm starting, then it's only going to go up from here.
Yeah, I was like, oh, so it's easy, you know? It's like, oh, you put a music out and then you're at the Grammy. It's like, right. this is so, you know, I look back now and I was such a kid. Like I had no idea what I was doing and just scrambling around. And, you know, it's like that, you know, if I knew then what I know now.
Right.
But it provided all the opportunity for me to, honestly, you know, I ended up doing it all, deciding to do it independently, but it helped finance me making a full length record and tour and let me do it the way I wanted to do it.
Right.
Without having to, you know, because there was some label talk where they're like, there's also the time when like John Mayer was sort of, and they're like, you could be John Mayer. And it's like, no. All due respect to that guy. Like, I'm not John Mayer. That's not the music I make.
Right.
And I saw like how they're just like, oh, we're going to put you in this category and sell you that way. And I was like, I don't think thank you so much, but that's not going to work because that's not what I sound like. But then it led to everything. And you know, then when we won the Grammy, it was crazy because we thought that we were up against like the Ray soundtrack, and it wasn't until they were announcing the category at the Grammy that we realized we weren't. And I had
how
had
did you not
had
know
had
that?
We were just, cause again, we were just dumb. We were dumb kids. And I had a few drinks at the open bar because I was like, we're not going to win anything, so I'm going to take advantage of this. And they called out Garden State, and Brad's like, let's go up to the podium. I was like, I'm not going up there.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. It was crazy. It was so much fun. It was such a fun time.
Yeah.
It's such an exciting time because that soundtrack itself was like a mixtape that, you know, Zach led the way and
right.
just kept calling his friends to be like, hey, do you have any ideas for other songs? And it was like a bunch of friends making a mixtape, so it felt like such a family kind of experience. And for it to have that kind of success was just nuts.
Yeah, that's crazy. So when you're then now touring or you're creating with this song that you can give to people as, here's this hit song I made, this is how it was received, but you don't feel like all of your music sounds like that to the point where it can be put into this box alongside John Mayer or others like that. Were there moments ever where you thought, okay, I need to go out and try to make the popular radio song John Mayer style, or has it always been I would rather stick to whatever my style is and find the people who want that versus go seeking out the radio hit?
The latter for sure. I mean, I've there are certain songs here and there that I wrote that I was like, oh, that's hooky, like that's fun, but I don't know that I ever, you know, also not having a label behind me putting a gun to the back of my head saying we're not going to put this out until
right.
you give us the single, I was able to. I mean, I think about the most successful songs I have on, you know, Spotify, whatever, and songs that are out in the world now, even bigger than Blue Eyes in a way, are songs that I don't even know if a label would have let me put on the record.
Right.
you know, weird off time ballads and stuff that I'm really proud of, but it was not what anyone would be considered a single, but that have turned into the songs that people come out to hear.
Yeah.
Which is all, I mean, you know, which is that. So I was much more of the idea of, okay, I'm going to find an audience and stick to that, rather than desperately trying to find a bigger and bigger audience every time.
Well, there's a lot of freedom in that, but it's scary too, right? Because if you're doing everything yourself, you also lose out on the benefits that you can have with the support of a bigger label and better
sure.
PR.
Every time it's just betting on myself.
Right.
Every time I put a record out, it's like spend a lot of money to do this thing and cross my fingers and pray that it works, you know, and hope that they like it because it's, you know, there's nobody like testing it before it comes out. But it's exciting and I get to do, you know, the thing about the TV and film stuff is it's financed me being able to make exactly the kind of music that I want to make without anybody telling me what to do.
Well, some of that includes getting into EDM a little bit. You've collaborated a couple times, right, with Tiësto. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's crazy. I didn't know anything about EDM music, other than,
yeah,
you know, that was
much.
About as much as I knew. And I got a call or an email from this guy Tice, and he wants to meet me and get a drink and talk about remixing my song, the song I did called Ride. And he was the nicest guy in the world. We had a burger and ate, and then at the end, he's like, so I'd like to do this. I was like, yeah, maybe we can work together. And he's like, oh, by the way, I go by Tiësto. I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. And I go home, and I Google Tiësto, and the first thing I see is a shot of him in front of, like, 300,000 people at, like, Carnival in Brazil. And I immediately emailed him. I was like, I would love to work with you.
Do you think he knew that you didn't know who he was?
Sort of. But I mean, but he was also sweet enough that he's a guy who he was just like, I want to work with songwriters. Like, you know, he had this massive success, but he wanted to take risks and do things with younger artists and writers. And he was great. He was great. He's a good dude.
Do you find that there are people who find you through that and then they're like, oh, I actually like all this music even without the beat? Or is it two separate groups of fans?
You got to think, like, the people who listen to, who are rolling their off and listen to EDM music at clubs in Ibiza, you know, like, they got to drive to work too, and they're not going to listen to EDM all. Like, maybe they wake
actually,
up the next morning, like,
my friend Kevin tries to make us listen to it all the time, no matter the context.
Oh,
and I was just in Napa.
No.
We were doing wine tasting, and I'm like, no, this is not a, this
you
is,
you cannot
this
wine,
is
yeah,
not
there's
the
no
situation for your EDM. I'm sorry. I draw the line. But you're right. Some of them are normal people, like my friend Kevin.
It did. Sorry, Kevin. It did work out that way that a lot of it kind of, because Ride, that remix kind of did well in Europe. And I found a whole new audience of kids. They're like, oh, actually, I like this brothers guy. You know, like the other mellow side. But it's crazy. Like seeing, I sang at the O2 Arena with Tiësto and seeing, like, you know, 10,000 kids with their glow sticks. And going crazy, and I'm just thinking, like, God, I wrote this song like almost in tears about a girl I was breaking up with, and these kids don't like hear that at all.
No.
It's the last thing anybody in this room cares about.
What was that feeling like? Because I always say the one feeling I've ever had where I felt like a rock star was in the Cubs and Blackhawks parades when I'm on top of the bus and it's just a million people. And I know they're not screaming for me at all. Like, one person is like, hey, Sarah. And other than that, it's not for me. But it's like the energy. And in fact, the first time I was on it with the Blackhawks, the male reporter next to me, we both look over and we both have like a tear in our eyes because it's like overwhelming. It's the, like, energy of all those people pressing on you and going nuts.
That was, if I had a Bono moment in my life, that was definitely it. Because they threw like little in-ears on me and just tossed me up on stage with a microphone. And those kids aren't used to, for the most part, seeing like a person come up and sing. like at those big shows. They're used to the DJ like pointing at them and having the headphones. And so just the fact that there was a human being on stage, they were just like, ah, it's crazy. They had, you know, and maybe like 20% of them knew who I was because of the song. But the rest of them would just say, it's a person, you know, and they just go crazy.
It's a real person performing live.
But I felt, you know, but also 10,000 kids on ecstasy feels like 100,000 people.
Right. Oh, I'm sure.
That's the calculation. That's the calculation.
No
that
one's
I made
holding
that.
Back. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like an explosion. It was so much fun.
We'll be back with more. That's What She Said.
Don't forget to go to ESPN and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain so you always have the latest episode. Don't forget to rate and review it as well and tell all your friends how awesome it is.
So tell me about the new album, Bruises. I was reading that the influences are Peter Gabriel and The Cure. I know one of the songs is dedicated to Molly Ringwald and sounds like it could be on the Pretty in Pink soundtrack.
Here's a quick listen at Crush.
It's been a long time since I thought that I'd be fine. I got beat up, bruised the last time that I tried. But a night with you has made me realize
so what are we're doing? We're doing like a full. Is it a concept album of sort of retro or no?
No, I don't. I mean, that's the funny thing. People are like, "Oh, so cool. So yeah, the retro thing's back, and you're in on that." I was like, "No. This is actually what I've always listened to. This is just what my taste is just coming around. I guess to like what's the kids like these days? I think I finally made. You know, because I got being Hotel Cafe and Blue Eyes and everything being pulled in the direction of singer-songwriter. I'm really proud of that music. But it's also like I don't want to be someone who makes the same record every time. Like, to me, that's part of the fun of it is going in different directions. And you know, like the single Crush is, you know, it's a true story. And it's about, like, it's about, you know, after having my heart messed up, the first person I met that I was like, oh, I can do this again. I might be able to do this again. And it made perfect sense to me that I would, even at, you know, my age, would write a song about a crush that using my musical heroes that I listened to when I had my first crush I was, you know, 12 or 13. And so I kind of started with that. And it felt this record also was, you know, got all these great synthesizers, old analog synthesizers that from back in the day. And that sort of started to influence the sound. And then suddenly I realized, okay, I get to go make that record that I wanted to make when I was 13 years old.
Yeah. And now you have the skills and the money and the access.
Yeah. And as much as it's like a make sound retro, I think it's the most personal thing I've ever made in my whole life because it's what I've always really, really wanted to do.
That's awesome. Have you heard back from Molly Ringwald yet?
No.
All right, we're going to work on that. Armada.
I know she published that thing where she had some beef with John Hughes. I don't know if you read that. She did a little Me Too thing with John Hughes talking about issues. So I think she has to distance herself from that stuff for now. But someday I'm going to meet Molly. But John Cryer did tweet about it. That was cool.
Oh, well, that's good. You're Ringwald adjacent.
Yeah. Getting closer and closer.
We will get the small but mighty Spanish Armada to do their best as well.
Spanish Armada.
And speaking of Spanish, before I let you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does and nobody expects.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It's the Spanish Inquisition. It's the 10 questions that everybody is asked, starting with number one. What is the talent you wish you had been gifted with?
pitching.
I like asking because everyone says singing, and so I had to get a better answer out of you.
No. Because I had a brief spell. I was a three-sport kid in Nashville because you just were in Nashville. And right. For a brief period of time, one season, they put me on the mound, and it was the most terrifying year of my entire life.
Was it the comebackers or was it the pressure?
It was the pressure. It was the pressure, and also the fact that there's another kid on our team who could throw like a. I'm like probably 12 or something. There's a kid who threw, no lie, I think he threw a 90 mile an hour fastball.
Whoa!
And they actually kicked. They had to kick him out because he broke somebody's rib.
Whoa!
And so then I followed up with. Then it's me like, hey Terry, you go try. Like you have pretty good form. I was like, no.
Oh, that's great. Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Wow. This week, I'd probably say Peter Gabriel's So.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah.
That touches on, I was walking around on this tour. Anytime I was just had time to like roll around a city, I would just put that on in my headphones and like go to museums and stuff. And that's a solid record.
I wish you would have said your own, like, wasn't it like Mariah Carey who likes to bone to her own music? I would say my first EP, greatest album of all time.
in the sack.
That's right. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Anyone for a day? I would switch lives with not Roseanne Barr today.
Oof.
I'm sorry, I just looked
or
at my,
anyone
my computer,
on her show.
My computer screen just came up, and I was
this might not air for a couple weeks, but people will still get the joke.
Yeah. I think I would want to switch. I think I'm going into just all sports stuff, but I just watching LeBron James play basketball in the last week. I'd want to know what that felt like.
Yeah, just own someone with a dunk.
I just want to know what it would feel like to be that dominant.
Yeah, absolutely.
And feel like the energy. Like what is that like when you can just do whatever you want to do?
Except beat the Warriors. Number four.
Don't tell Josh Braden that because it'll make him cry.
That's true.
He's a Cavs fan.
Except you're better than Michael Jordan. Number four.
Yeah.
What's the most scared you've ever been?
Most scared I've ever been is probably going back to when I sang at the O2 Arena with Tiësto. That's the most terrifying things I've ever done because they didn't let me have a sound check.
Oh wow!
So I went up there to sing a song, and it was a remix of a song, and it was a live remix. So I didn't even know when I started and stopped singing, and I just kind of had to guess.
Oh boy!
On like the biggest stage I'd ever been in my entire life, and it was
Thank God everyone was on drugs. They actually, yeah. Most of them thought you were a flamingo. So you're good. Number five, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
Let's see. It's been a while since I've done anything totally stupid. I'm trying to think of, embarrassed. I don't know.
You must not have been much of a nerd, right?
What'd you say?
You must not have been too much of a nerd if, like, no one ever just, you know, pantsed you or gave you a giant wedgie and hung you up from the bathroom stall or.
No, I guess, yeah. I mean, now that I think of it in those terms, I was at a party where I was flirting with this girl that I thought was super cute, and some douchebag football player threw me in the pool.
Oh.
That wasn't cool. But the good news is, as he was throwing me in the pool, I grabbed him by the neck and pulled him in with me.
Nice.
So
there
I made it look like it was, hey, we're all in this together.
That's perfect. Number six, what would you consider your biggest failure?
You're going so deep.
I know, man.
I'm jet lagged off a plane from Australia.
You are jet lagged, but thinking, you know you're a deep thinker, man. You're a singer songwriter. Your emotions are right at the surface at all times.
I'm contemplating my entire life right now while I'm dizzy and loopy. My biggest failure was probably not. I think, I mean, relating to everything we're talking about, but I think my biggest failure was not being ready when the success of Blue Eyes happened. I think I was such a kid and I was so wide eyed, and to me music was about drinking and having fun, and I don't think I was serious enough at the time.
Right, you could have built on it more.
And it can't, it's no regrets. But looking back now, it's like I look at the level of professionalism with like young music people now and realize that I was an idiot.
Yeah. I could get that. Number seven, what habit or quality?
You're like, I remember you back then.
I'm like, yeah, no, I mean, rings a bell. What habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Kindness. Mm. I don't think I'm the most talented person in the world. I think I care a lot about what I do, but I think it's more than anything, being good to the people around me. And, as I've had any kind of success and in doing so have built an incredible like world of friends in music industry. And that I value at the end of the day, like I don't care if I have a giant hit single or whatever. I want to die with the most amount of friends and being the kind of person that collects those friends because they're good people.
Yeah. I love that answer. That one's great. Number eight, have you ever been in a fist fight?
Yeah. I mean, I went to school in Chicago. Of course, I've been in a fist fight. Can I say this real quick? When coming from Australia, I went to see a movie in Australia, and they had an ad before one of the movies about coward punching.
Ooh.
And which is evidently such a huge thing in Australia that they have to have an ad for it. When people
like a sucker
walk up
punch?
And punch somebody. Like sucker, yeah, sucker punch. I would say we would call it a sucker punch.
Wow.
But that coward punching is such a big deal. That before I went to see the Avengers, they had an ad for it.
But it made me think
about back in the day in Chicago. But I've been hit in the face. I've hit people in the face. Being hit in the nose is the worst thing in the world.
Ugh.
But my problem was I had so many friends who would get so drunk that they didn't know who the enemy was anymore.
Oh no!
And so we'd have to pull.
Just fighting
it would
each
be
other.
It'd be a group of like four of us pulling a friend of ours out of a party to save his life before he gets jumped by like 15 people. And as we're going out of the party, he's just swinging and connecting. I've probably been hit by my friends more than I've been hit by my enemies.
Oh, men are so stupid. and by the way, the coward punching, that's like in Miami when I was down there, maybe in like 07, there was a big billboard that said never ever shake a baby. And I was like, we need billboards for this? Like, that's awful. That is really terrifying. Number nine, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Procrastination.
Mm.
I mean, it did take me 8 years to put out a third record, so if that says anything.
That's kind of like the blessing and the curse of not having someone who sits and tells you what to do and micromanages.
Exactly. But it's like a lot of things happened in my life that led to that. But I think more than ever now, especially putting this record out, I'm trying to be much more active in like constantly making things and constantly getting ideas out there and pushing forward, because I can easily get lost on a couch.
Yeah. Finally, number 10, what three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Thoughtful. Talented. I mean, I hope maybe some talent. I hope somebody will be said talented. And tough.
That's a good combination. And finally,
through stuff.
That's good. That's good. Who would you recommend I have a conversation with on this podcast?
So you can be like anybody, right? Is it all?
Yeah.
Is it anybody in the world?
Anybody in the world that presumably would maybe come on my podcast. Some people are like Barack Obama. I'm like, on it.
Yeah, dude. Seriously. I think, he's a really interesting guy. He's very cool. Nathan Fillion?
Yeah.
Nathan Fillion, who's on Castle and stuff, he's a bud of mine in L.A. He's an incredibly engaging, very cool human being. I think you should have him on your show.
All right. Let's make it happen.
And he's doing a new TV show, too.
Perfect. Synergy. awesome. Well, it's awesome to talk to you, Carrie. Thanks so much for making some time.
Thank you. Well, thanks for I'm glad I was able to make it through an hour on jet lag.
That's right. And now you get to sleep.
Hopefully some of the words. Yeah, I'm literally falling asleep right now. not because of you, just because my body can't handle it anymore. I just hope I said words that made sense. Thank you.
You did. You did. You made a lot of sense. Hopefully no one listening will be falling asleep either. awesome, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks, buddy.
Oh, and another thing.
It's time for this week's That's What She Read. And I know in the intro I said I wanted to get away from the bad news of the day, but my internet friend Sarah Benincasa, who actually was on the podcast a while back, you can go back and find the interview with her. It was fantastic. But she wrote such a great piece for Medium that I wanted to share it, even though it is a sort of dark topic. She wrote about Anthony Bourdain's suicide, and I'll just read you the opening of the story because it's so good. She writes, "When we look at a mountain, we see one face of it. And even if we wake up and gaze at that same mountain every single morning of our lives, we do not see its wholeness. We can hike it, fly over it, traverse its circumference 1,000 times, and still we won't see its entirety, every layer, every element, every atom. To know a mountain or a person is to see a whole being in its fullness at all times, in all seasons, every mood, every moment. If there is a God, this is what God sees. But we are not gods, and so our view, no matter how vast, is always partial." I admire Anthony Bourdain as much as anyone who never met the man could. I say admire in the present tense rather than the past, because I don't see a future in which I will not admire him, and I certainly don't live in a present moment in which I have anything less than absolute respect for the man, be he here, elsewhere, or nowhere. In 2001, the Taliban blew up a pair of giant medieval-era statues of the Buddha in the Bamiyan Valley in the Hazarat region of Afghanistan, northwest of Kabul. At 115 and 175 feet tall, carved out of a cliff, the Buddhas adorned part of the Silk Road that runs from China through the Hindu Kush mountain region onward to parts west. For centuries, they inspired awe. How could humans with such limited means build towering monuments like these? And then they were gone, profanely smote to smithereens in a giant FU to cultural diversity, to real history, to heritage, and to international presence. I admire them still, though they are dust. You don't forget what emerges from the earth or what returns to it. And she goes on to talk about her own issues with depression and the issues that other people who are not suffering have with suicide, feeling that it's selfish and that you're taking yourself away from people who love you. And her own struggle is inspiring and her words on it are wonderful. So I highly recommend that you go read it. Again, it's on Medium. It's Sarah Benincasa and the title is When They Leave on Anthony Bourdain and Me and You. Thanks as always for lasting about an hour with me.